who is a Presbyterian minister and director of the Institute for Religion and Medicine at the University of Illinois Medical Center, who has studied under Dr. Thielicke in Germany. And to my left is Robert Benny, who's a professor of church and society at LSTC. We thought that the role, the function that this time could play in our overall visit with Dr. Thielicke could be described as follows. First of all, for those people who would appreciate some orientation into Thielicke's larger thought, who he is and what he generally stands for theologically, for those, we could give some orientation in this session. For those people who, in a little more relaxed setting, simply want to ask questions, whether it's questions about the lecture, whether it's questions about Thielicke's theology, or whether it's a simple question of how old is he and what has he been doing, those questions would be fair game here. We also recognize that even though we think we know something about Professor Thielicke, there certainly are people in the audience who may know as much or more about Thielicke and want you to feel free to contribute your wisdom. We'll have as our basic ground rules roughly a 60-minute session here so that we have a break before the reception and conversation with Dr. Thielicke himself. We met Dr. Thielicke when we picked him up at the airport last evening, looked at the schedule, and he says, what is that affair you're having at 2 p.m.? We told him what it was, and he said, well, he would like to take a nap after lunch. But he said, knowing that you are talking about me, I will sleep with burning ears. We'll start off with just some very brief comments and then throw things open for give and take. And the first question that I want all of us up here to begin with is, what is the single thing that you find most impressive or most noteworthy, either positive or negative, in Thielicke's work? Each of the people here has a particular perspective because they've used Thielicke's thought and have studied it from a particular angle. So I'll start with Bob Benny.
You don't want to answer your own question?
Well, I've got an answer, but I'll start with you.
He springs the question on us, then doesn't answer it. Well, when I think of Helmut Thielicke and his significance, I begin with certain obvious things. One, that he's very popular in America. And lay people read his books, pastors read his books. He has many speaking engagements in America and has been around America a lot. Then you go to Europe, particularly Germany, and you mention offhandedly that Thielicke is going to be at our seminary in October. And one of the academic theologians will say, well, why do you listen to Thielicke? And there's some critical remarks, sometimes scurrilous remarks, that come up in relation to Thielicke's name. Now, that's not pervasive across the boards, but there's a very interesting tension there. And I reflect a little bit about why that's the case. And I believe it has to do with Thielicke's significance. And when I was trying to think of a brief phrase to sum up what I thought Thielicke was all about, I would call him a theologian of the middle range. A theologian of the middle range. I don't mean by that he comes from a geographical area of the country. I mean about four specific things. One, the first thing, is that he's in the middle range between highly technical, specialized theology and ethics and being a popularizer. He's not a popularizer in the sense that he has no original ideas or doesn't generate his own original contributions to the theological ethical discussion. He does have original insights, so he's not a popularizer in that sense. Neither is he a highly technical theologian or ethicist. He's not a purist, a pure type in that sense. And because he's that theologian in the middle range with a lot of capacity to communicate, he's communicated with the laity, and in some sense that's a sin in academic circles in Germany. So that when he fills the Mikkelskirche in Hamburg with 3,000 or 4,000 people Sunday after Sunday, or for a series on Christian belief for lay people, and he fills the church, I have the temerity to believe that that irritates and rankles some of the academic theologians. So, and I always accuse them of being somewhat envious of Tillich because the lay people respond to him so much. So he's a theologian of the middle range in the sense that he lies somewhere between being a popularizer and being a pure theological, ethical thinker. He's a theologian of the middle range in that he lies between, in the middle range, between the deductive and inductive modes of argumentation. German theology has been known to be rather deductive. You derive things from structures of thought and then apply them to the situation. American theology has been known to be more deductive or pragmatic, beginning with the situation and arguing back to questions of principle.
Inductive.
Did I say deductive? Inductive. And I find that Tillich is in the middle range there, too. He's a theologian of the middle range. If you look at his books, he'll begin his Ethics of Sex with an excursus into biblical anthropology, but right after that, he'll have a section on the phenomenology of human sexual life. So he's inductive to some extent, but not as much as an American pragmatic kind of thinker would be. I believe he's a theologian in the middle range in a third sense, that he lies between Lutheran tradition in a kind of static way, and innovation, a theologian with a new agenda. He's neither one of those. He's not a repristination theologian trying to repristinate Lutheran tradition, nor is he a theologian that has an exciting new agenda operating out of, say, eschatological thought or liberation motifs or something like that. I have an analogy that I'd toss out. I'm not so sure it holds, but most of you are familiar with the American scene enough to know the function that Bill Lazarus plays in American Lutheranism. I believe there's an analogy there that the theologian in the middle range between tradition and innovation does a very important task in the theological world. He kind of cuts off and rejects and purifies the tradition of perversions and accretions that a static traditionalism picks up. And Tillich throughout the Ethics of Sex is very interesting. He casts off and puts to rest some of the nasty accretions that static traditionalism has picked up. So he drops that off, but he resists very much a kind of faddist approach to theology. He doesn't he doesn't respond very much to imaginative new ideas that are going to change the face of theology. So like Bill Lazarus, he does the neither nor style. It's neither this, which is the perversion of the old tradition, nor is it this, which is kind of crazy faddishness in the new scene. So it's kind of a dynamic middle range of thought. Well, finally, that's the third point. The fourth point, I believe that in a very interesting way, he's in the middle range between a German style and an American style. This is a little bit lighter. Americans respond to Tillich because he has a certain kind of flair to him. He always dresses real sharp, and he's not stodgy. He's got a little bit of I don't know what you call it.
Mitmenschlichkeit.
No, that isn't what I mean. No, but a relaxed and informal style. He's very gracious and informal and relaxed with people. And I think Americans are attracted to that. And Germans sometimes put off by that, although the lay people not put off by that. Those are some of the things that I would lift up in terms of the significance, in a broad general context, the significance of Tillich.
Thanks, Bob. Since we decided to move in this direction, since John Holden is going to make some comments that are more specific than Bob or I will just make a couple of statements about what impresses me first off. There are two things that impress me first off about Tilaka. One is his person. I first knew him in 54 when I went to Germany to study under him to find only at Tübingen to find only that 54 was the year he was moving to Hamburg. And my scholarship did not permit me to change universities. And the minute I got to Tübingen, which at that time was a small university town set in a beautiful semi-mountainous area, which has a long, long tradition at the university, particularly in theology, as soon as I got there, people were talking about Tilaka. They were talking about Tilaka because of the force of his personal magnetism. He was rector of the university, which is a rotating position in German universities, at least at that time. When he came to the university as rector every day, he came in a chauffeur-driven Mercedes. He wore a white linen suit and white shoes, and that offended the Swabians of Tübingen. And yet, they knew that there was that this was a man of substance, and not material substance, but spiritual substance, not only for his actions during the war, but also because they knew that he has an integrity and an independence that he doesn't permit to be compromised. This uncompromisability of his person came out to me later then in the succeeding years. When I was in Europe in 68, I made inquiries about Tilaka, and people would tell me he may be the single most popular university professor in all of Germany, and certainly one of the most advanced in terms of educational reforms at the university. And this didn't surprise me, knowing his personal magnetism. Then when I went back in 71 and 72, I found out that Tilaka had once again expressed his personal uncompromisability in the situation of the left-wing student revolts. At first, the left-wing students, and you have to remember, the left-wing students are a very significant force in Europe, and in Germany and in Hamburg, which is one next to Berlin, was the most left university in Germany. The left-wing students had naturally thought that perhaps Tilaka would be one of their friends because he had been for university reforms. But Tilaka, showing that he was in nobody's hip pocket, was critical of them, even though he was by no means a conventional conservative. This, perhaps they turned more bitterly on him, you know, left the whole Marxist ideology oftentimes is sharper in its criticism of the reformist person than the right-wing person. They reacted especially bitterly to him. They disrupted his classes, and when he was preaching one of his sermons in the Michael's Church, which drew, you know, thousands, I think that seats 5,000 and he fills it, they disrupted one of his sermons on, I believe, in the Christmas season, and it was scurrilously attacked in the press. Then, on the other hand, just last year, when the Baader-Meinhof gang, which is roughly comparable to the Chicago 7, it's more comparable to SLA, the Simeonese Liberation Army. Yeah.
Be sure you clarify the SLA.
Yeah. Yeah. Not. The bishop of Berlin visited the Baader and Meinhof, the leaders of the gang, in prison, and the right-wing press in Germany attacked the bishop. Who stands up and defends the bishop but Helmut Tilaka, saying the bishop had no choice. He was a pastor of the church. A pastoral call was needed. He would have been totally irresponsible not to visit them. So this independence and uncompromisability, it impresses me. Now, this comes out theologically, I think, in an important way, and I'll make this brief, that Tilaka is always, it seems to me, been very clear about the fact that the church and the Christian faith must penetrate the world without being taken over by the world. When I was a student in Germany, I just come from a setting in which it was very popular to talk about the world setting the agenda for the church. And the world asks the church questions, and the world challenges the church. When I got over to Germany, I picked up a book that said, was entitled, Questions That the Church Puts to the World. And he completely turned the tables on this conventional mode of thought and said, when the church takes the world seriously, the church has got some questions to ask too. And then he proceeded to ask questions about democracy, about justice, about the superficiality that he saw in the secularized mode of thought. Now in his new Dogmatics, which is just coming out in English, which I intend to use as a textbook when the second volume comes out. It won't be out for another year or two. He makes the same point in which he says that all of theology takes place between actualization and accommodation. It is one thing to accommodate the faith to the world, which he rejects, and another thing to actualize the faith in the world, which he says is the task of the church, is the task of theology. I think we saw some of that in his lecture this morning, especially in his response to my question, which I don't think he had time enough to draw out, where he was trying to walk this line between accommodation and actualization.
Okay. Well, I'd like to pick up on that last question, which was raised this morning, concerning the prolongation of life. I'm working in the field of theology and medicine, and Tielicke has been a very active and prolific writer in this field, and this has made a deep impression upon me and has influenced me in my own work and the development of my career. One of the things which is characteristic of Tielicke's thought is the way in which he takes seriously but critically the Roman moral Catholic tradition. For example, he appreciates the fact that moral theology calls attention to significant social problems, which, you know, has not always been the case in an individualistic Protestant ethic. So when he begins to deal with, say, such a problem as the prolongation of life, he takes up the historic discussion over the use of ordinary means versus extraordinary means for the prolongation of life. That is that in the Roman Catholic moral tradition, the physician is obligated to use ordinary means to prolong life, but not extraordinary or what we call heroic measures for the prolongation of life. He cites this, and he comes back to raise some serious questions about this. But this is a point of departure, and frequently the Roman moral Catholic tradition is a point of departure for public discussion of issues, not only in medicine, but in many other fields. Now, he mentioned this morning that this distinction between biological life and human life. And this, too, is very characteristic of his thought, that he is able to show that many of the technical issues in our modern society are basically ethical, anthropological, theological issues. For when he says the physician has an obligation to prolong human life, and not just, but not biological life, immediately the issue is raised, what is human life? Now, there are two forces which I see working in his thought as he attempts to answer that question. First of all, the biblical tradition in which man is seen as a dialogic personality in terms of the I-thou. The biblical story of creation calls attention to this. The animal world, the material natural world is created by divine fiat. But when it comes to the creation of man, communication, dialogue enters the picture, and man then has a commission to work out the meaning of his existence in partnership and cooperation with God. Then the story of the fall plays a very important part in his thought, namely that the fall signifies for him that one must never identify guilt and fate. Man is responsible for the mess that he's made of things, and he can't blame it on nature and matter. Here he begins to show that it's characteristic of his thought that he stands in the biblical tradition rather than the Greek philosophical tradition. But there is also another important force at work in his theology. He is like Bultmann too. He baptizes some of the modern thinkers, and he takes the thought of Martin Heidegger seriously. Heidegger is a man who devoted his life to the study of being. What is human being as over against animal being? And Thielicke referred to this morning when he talked about the consciousness of the self as a decisive criterion of human existence, which should be seen as over against the rationalistic tradition, which sees man only in terms of, primarily in terms of reason. Okay, so once you begin to see human existence in terms of self-consciousness, you have a clue to deal with this problem of the prolongation of life. What does it mean to be conscious of the self? It means to know that you have a future. To know that you have a future is to know that you must deal with the reality of suffering and death in your life, and that man faces the future in anguish and hope. The animal, as over against the human being, is characterized by being tied to the moment. So I think this is a background to that anthropological, existential anthropological element, which is very strong in his thought. But for when consciousness of self does become the decisive criterion of human existence, this means then that suffering is, in Thielicke's thought, theology, a very meaningful concept. It means that, because you must suffer and die, you are obligated to respond to this. Whether you like it or not, you're going to respond to it. And suffering then is something which is very basic to human existence. You can fight against it, you can accept it, you can permit it to be the basis of either defeat or enlightenment, you can deny it or protest against it, or you can integrate it into your life. Man, in contrast to the animal, is a being who suffers ethically. And suffering, as Thielicke sees it, can become for man a productive task. This is why he takes up an argument with physicians who do not want to face up to this obligation as part of their work as physicians. He sees the physician as having the responsibility to help the patient to understand the suffering and death elements in his life, and to integrate those elements into his understanding of himself. Because Thielicke takes consciousness of the self as the decisive criterion of human existence, he is pointing to at least a theoretical point where human being ceases to be human being and becomes animal being. That would be the irreparable and complete loss of consciousness of self at that point. Now, he's fully aware of the fact that he's slithering over the quantitative. He knows many things that are going on in medicine. He reads a great deal of medical literature. Going back to university days when he was suffering from a lethal disease and spent much time in the hospitals, and during that time he devoured medical textbooks. He is then suggesting that this that human being does cease to be human being, becomes animal being, and then therefore one can raise questions to the medical community about their attempt to prolong this biological entity, or preparat, or however you want to translate that. He then takes up again, he tends to take up again the Catholic distinction between the ordinary and extraordinary means, and he says that this is looks fine on paper, but it's not very helpful in actual practice, because what was extraordinary yesterday may be ordinary today. Does this then mean that the theologian, the ethicist, the community it should be mesmerized by biomedical technology? Well, Tielik is never mesmerized by anything. I think he has another approach than the dogmatic moral theological tradition. And I would call this, I don't think he calls it this, but I would call it an interrogative ethics. It's an ethic which raises some questions which are obscured in other disciplines, which theology is concerned with, which sensitizes that community, and doesn't tell them exactly what to do, as the moral theologian may try to do, but makes a significant contribution by its questions. For example, if man is destined to die, doctor, doesn't he have a right to die? Is the piecemeal prolongation of life really prolonging life, or is it a prolongation of agony? Not dogmatic statements which rob the physician of his personality by making up his mind for him, but at least calling attention to these important aspects of human existence, which are easily obscured in a discipline which is primarily concerned with other questions, the development of biomedical techniques and so forth.
That would be comparable theologically to the book on that I mentioned, where he didn't just come out and condemn secularization, but he raised questions to it.
I think maybe I've talked long enough to just give you some insight as to where he's going in a specific ethical field.
In terms of overpopulation, are not problems of birth control, but problems of distribution of resources and distribution of food. And it is a very conservative perspective on the use of birth control. Now, how does that fit with defining human life as self-consciousness? Because I would think that if you define it as self-consciousness, then the fetus really doesn't have much worth at all, because there's not self-consciousness there, at least as far as we know. Usually there has to be a social context in which self-consciousness arises. So is that a contradiction in his thought, that he can be so place such high value on the fetus, but yet at the other end of the life spectrum, he's...
In response to this particular question that you raise, a few years ago, I had a very interesting conversation with Professor Lucio Lombardo Radici, who is professor of mathematics at the University of Rome, and who was a member of the Central Action Committee of the Italian Communist Party. And the matter of birth control came up, and he said that he agreed with the papal position. But he said the difference was that we Marxists, we communists, can deliver the system which will make possible this handling of the overpopulation problem without birth control means. In other words, he was saying that the Marxists see that there is an economic problem underneath the overpopulation problem, coming at it from a different perspective. Tielik makes a distinction when he deals with this problem between the order of nature and the order of creation, as I understand it. And the order of you do not apply the order of creation directly to the problems of actual historical existence. So I think he has been misread many times on this particular issue, and whenever the concept of the Schöpfungsordnung comes up, people confusing that with the order of nature. In other words, in the when he points to the order of creation, he's doing the same thing that Lucio Lombardo Radici is. He's pointing to a vision of what the perfect society is like. Only Marxism believes that it can be, there's a historical locus for it. So in the order of creation, you would have a society, you would have man in a society in which his instincts and his values would be in harmony. Now, Tillich never imagines that you can apply the order of creation directly to the problems of human existence. In fact, he warns against this and says that this would lead to fanaticism, just as applying, say, the order of redemption directly to the problems, as the Marxist does implicitly, leads to fanaticism. So I think some confusion arises here because it's not clear as to how he relates creation and redemption to historical existence. But he has the advantage of calling attention to the fact that panic over population statistics is not a good mood in which to tackle these problems. He appreciates, again, the Roman moral tradition. He says, here, I think this is characteristic. He does not always agree with what the Roman position is as far as its statement is, but he appreciates maybe the intention that lies behind that statement. And I think perhaps Catholicism, because it was boxed in on the birth control, was more inclined to see the other factors working in the overpopulation problem, such as hunger. And that's what he says in The Ethics of Sex, that that hunger, and now I think we Protestants are just beginning to appreciate that, which he has been saying for such a long time. And so what appeared to be conservative now becomes very much on the forefront of what we see as our task.
This would also be an example of defining the human in terms of self-consciousness, in the sense he's not talking about the self-consciousness of the fetus as the ethical question, but he's talking about the self-consciousness of those of us who have to deal with the question of birth control.
And by no means do I mean to imply that consciousness of the self exhausts what Tillich is saying about the meaning of human existence, because he deals with this problem in terms of, I think, a beautiful concept, what he calls the alien dignity of man. Now, to me, this is extremely important because the tendency has been to, if you define the dignity of man in terms of his biological worth, that means that you get into the Superman tradition. If you define man's dignity in terms of his social worth, you're in totalitarian communist bag. But Tillich locates the dignity of man in the heart of God. That's what he means by the fact that man is loved by God. And this is an important critique over against these definitions of the dignity of man in terms of biological worth, which puts the cripple at a disadvantage, or in terms of a social worth, which may put the poor at a disadvantage. So there, in Tillich's thought, there's some very revolutionary ideas.
Well, he's a member of the what we would call the Executive Council of his provincial church. So in a sense, they've accepted his there. Also in the German scene, I'll just make a couple comments. Mm-hmm. John probably knows more. In the German scene, you have to recognize, I know this sounds one-sided and dreadful, but I think it's factual. In the German church, the university theologian drives church people to distraction because he can't communicate. So you'll hear people like at the evangelical academies and other places saying, we can't ask Professor so-and-so to speak because none of the laity will understand him. So that I would say that the church really appreciates the fact that Thielicke speaks to the laity. And the sort of thing Bob was talking about, he's had the custom of devoting a week to what we would, when I was growing up, we called it a preaching mission in the big cathedral. And he incorporated some very interesting techniques. He would give the lecture, and then he would break up the people into groups, voluntarily, naturally, and you might have anywhere 50 people in a group, and they would discuss his lecture and other related questions for a while, and then a group of his students who had were his assistants in this would pass out sheets and made it possible for people who wanted more discussion or wanted to get some pastoral care out of it to make themselves known, and then throughout the week, his assistants then would be tracking down these people and saying, okay, well, let's talk some more, let's do this. And the kind of opposition that Bob talked about, I think, is mainly from his academic peers and not from the church. I think the church has, the people who are in Germany who are concerned for church renewal respond warmly to Thielicke. What do you think?
But he's seen as a representative of the church rather than independent evangelist.
Definitely. He's identified with the established church, right?
Yeah, I have involved him a number of times in speaking to what you call the laity in this country. That is, he has spoken to medical groups, which we have assembled at our institute. I think the response that characterizes a thinking, you know, medical scientist or one who is concerned about the ethical problems in modern medicine is that made by Dean Katsonis, who is Dean of the Peoria School of Medicine at the University of Illinois and who was professor of medicine at the Abraham Lincoln School for many years. He said, Thielicke is, I always have the feeling, Thielicke is thinking through our problems with us. Now, this goes back to what you were saying earlier, which I think is very important, about the deductive and the inductive. Thielicke has discussed this in his ethics, where he characterizes the Barthian approach, or the approach of the Barman Declaration, as the deductive approach to ethics, in which you state a biblical verse, and then you draw implications from that. In the case of the Barman, it was a protest against the German Christians and the National Socialist State. On the other hand, the inductive approach would be characterized by Paul Tillich, where you start with the problems which society is facing and then work on bringing your theological resources. Thielicke is well aware of the fact that Barth has probably done a great deal of thinking about the social problems before he has stated his biblical thesis. And Tillich has brought with him a great deal of theological background, too, so that the difference between, or the polarity between inductive and deductive is not as great as one might imagine at first. Thielicke, as a personality, I think, leans more towards the inductive approach. This characteristic.
Carl.
How would you compare Thielicke with Bonhoeffer in terms of taking the two in ethics, your ethics?
Well, I would suspect, one of the the quickest thing that comes to mind is the context in which they were writing. That the crisis context in which Bonhoeffer had to do his writing gave his ethics a certain kind of passionate intensity that you probably don't find in Thielicke, who has a different kind of context that he's writing in. I would suspect that also that Bonhoeffer was more influenced by Bardianism than Thielicke was. Wouldn't you say the Christology and deriving so much of the ethics out of Christology would be an emphasis in Bonhoeffer that I don't think you get in Thielicke?
Another thing there, I think you could you could look at the shape their work took, although naturally Bonhoeffer, we don't know what would happen if he had lived longer. But Bonhoeffer deals with a theological motif and the conformation ethics, conforming to Christ. But as John pointed out about Thielicke's respect for the Catholic moral tradition, you look at Thielicke's ethics, and first of all, it's how many volumes in German? It's two big volumes. Yeah, four volumes in German. It's two volumes in English. Each one is bigger than this volume. And you realize that he understands that there are X number of things that an ethicist has to deal with. And so it's the only thing, I think it is the only ethical work, certainly since the Second World War, and maybe one of the few in the 20th century, ethical work by a Lutheran that has the comprehensive scope that you identify with Catholic moral theology. That's one thing we have to realize about his scope. You know, he has just about finished his Dogmatics, a three-volume Dogmatics. He's written the four-volume Systematic Ethics, besides his sermons and his books like Theology of Death and Sex. He's a man who, in the classical tradition, feels that there is a whole field that a theologian is supposed to cover if he's going to be faithful to his vocation, and he does it. Now, I'm not saying that Bonhoeffer is any less of a theologian, but Bonhoeffer didn't approach ethics or theology that way. Even when he had the relative calm of the pre-war university situation, he dipped in here and there more than covering the systematic scope.
I would suspect that Bonhoeffer has an interesting, that there would be an interesting contrast, though, that Bonhoeffer was pressed to think radically about the structure of the church in a way that Thielicke hasn't been pressed to. That is, the German church had gone one direction, and Bonhoeffer, talking about the communion of saints and new forms of church life in this radical new situation, had to do that. I'm not so sure Thielicke has had to do that. And one of the critical questions I would ask Thielicke is whether his own personal dynamism and mystique is so successful in the present structures of the church in Germany, whether that doesn't blind him to some of the terrific structural problems they've got in a state church situation. And in that sense, I don't think Thielicke has been pressed to spring loose from the structural situation as it is. Bonhoeffer had to spring loose from it and think of fresh forms of church life.
I think there is something that ought to be mentioned that is strong in Bonhoeffer and also in Paul Lehmann and Reinhold Niebuhr and Helmut Thielicke's thought. And that is that all of these issues lead up to the doctrine of forgiveness. And that Thielicke, I felt, was doing that again this morning. I believe that he has understood that ethics is a presupposition to the proclamation of the gospel. And it would be remiss in this Lutheran setting not to call attention to that. Now, the difference, I think, is, as you say, related to what are the issues, that the devil doesn't stand still, and Bonhoeffer had to deal with the problem of euthanasia, for example, and Barth, too, in terms of what was going on in Nazi Germany. Thielicke now is saying, we must not, I hope I'm understanding him correctly, is saying that we should not look at the problem of euthanasia solely in terms of what happened in totalitarian Germany, but we should recognize that the issue of euthanasia has become worthy of discussion because of the rapid advances taking place in biomedical sciences.
I wanted to go back to some of the comments Dr. Chang made before. I think it was in response to your question. It sounded to me, although I realized that he had to go very quickly to respond, as if he was somewhat lacking appreciation for the tremendous impact that the social structures have on the individual, and therefore the necessity of dialogue between theology and sociology. Now, granted, he's strongly influenced by what's going on in the medical field, but medicine is a pretty individualistic orientation, too. Is it an accurate impression to say that Tielica is much more influenced by the individualistic approach, or is he also cognizant of, appreciative of, the importance of social structures and
I think that this is a grave misunderstanding of Tielica's thought. I know he said to me that when he's been accused of this individualism by Dorothy Sola and others in the left-wing tradition in Germany, he said, obviously they haven't read my ethics, and I think they haven't myself. I would agree with that this is an unfair criticism for precisely in the field of medical ethics. He calls for he alludes to the fact that Marx has gone down in history because he realized that the poverty problem was not to be dealt with by almsgiving, but he recognized that this was a social problem, a structural problem. Tielica says we're at the same point in medicine today, that we have to come up with a comprehensive approach to the problems which are being created by this rapid input of biomedical technology. So it's Tielica is not an individualistic ethicist. That's a misunderstanding.
I think we should press him on this to bring him out more, because the way I asked my question, of course, in a German situation, he would have thought he was talking to a Marxist student, you know, and he gave an answer that was very much, you know, oriented towards that. It would be interesting to press him to communicate this in a way that speaks in the American situation. I was thinking, for example, of, and I want to ask him this if someone else doesn't, how does he think an American black would react to his statement, "We work to make society just a little bit better, a little more just, a little more open," that phrase, "little more," because I'm sure that he can respond to that, but I'm not sure that he's thinking in terms of the American political situation.
Well, in regard to that, one of the sharpest criticisms recently I've heard of Tielica was his stance he took in South Africa. He made a South African trip very recently and in effect endorsed, perhaps not uncritically, but endorsed the step-by-step movement toward liberalization in South Africa. And some of the more left-wing or liberal types in Germany were terribly upset about that. They thought it was a scandal that he had identified himself so strongly with the South African establishment. Do you know anything about that situation?
Well, I don't know everything that Tielica has said. I do know things which he has said on this issue, which perhaps could be added to our discussion. He does not like to, he likes to preserve a certain distance between the sanctities of faith and the ambiguities of politics. As Reinhold Niebuhr did, too. He would say that perhaps, and I think he has said this in the African Diary, if I were in an African nation, I could very easily be a revolutionary. But he would be a revolutionary who would not identify his politics with his theological affirmation. I mean, he wants to guard against the kind of fanaticism which the church has so often brought into the political and social life of mankind. He wants, on the matter of the issue that you brought up, he also said this morning, he said, I want to immunize against us, against the kind of utopianism which prevents progress.
Yeah,
Tillich is a very, I think Tillich is a very complex thinker who can very easily be misunderstood or seen only a fragment of it is thought to be seen. I remember one seminar in Tübingen. He said at the conclusion that, we started off with what seemed to be a very simple question, and now we see it's a very complex issue. This has been a wonderful seminar.
You see how dialectical he is. That lecture, if the structure impressed me because of that kind of complexity, he talks about he doesn't want to engage in the wishful thinking of an afterlife and beyond. He doesn't like the word beyond. On the other hand, you can't think very long about human existence without coming up against realities that make you think about the beyond. And it reminds me of the story I heard, I don't know if it's an apocryphal story or not, that he originally went into theology because he it was the most learned and complex of all disciplines. And he felt the challenge. Did you have something you wanted to ask or comment?
Encourage ministers. You know, we are involved in the situation, for example, intensive care, where somebody is breathing, but the doctor says there's no consciousness. It seems that in our society, our laity are caught up in so many influences which perhaps bear upon them unconsciously. For example, the mysticism out of a funeral parlor. I mean, the music and almost the setting of some sort of seance. Potentially or unintentionally, they are there. The decision of a young wife with the doctor to keep the heart machine going. Well, this is a reality. Is he alive or isn't he alive? This is really a concrete issue. And then we're caught up in the adolescent biblical concepts where we have the Bible in which you tell the children the Bible stories, and then they get joined and unite with the church, and all that's the end of their education. So they're left with this adolescent theological concept which has to carry them through the rest of their life. And then they go to university, and they are brought into the scientific where they question, you know, whether religion is real or whether it is, you know, a dream. Or can you tell us all about those concepts? So we're caught up with the reality is the Bible. Temporary life in the Bible. And then take a simple question that I thought about never did answer. The doctrine of the fall, in other words, the wages of sin is death, is a simple biblical phrase. Well, if everybody didn't die, how would we feed them all? And if the animals didn't die, what universe would you pick up to hold? And yet we are taught the wages of sin is death. And how do you answer the very simple, complex questions?
I hope you'll ask Tillich of that in the reception. Do you want to respond to that or make a response, sir?
Well, that's kind
of. I was serious. I wish that you would.
Besides this, you've got changes theology, we have to update theology.
You're talking about this, use Tillich's own terms, the actualization of the faith in the real world that you're dealing with.
Yeah.